Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd. It's Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We are coming to you live from the Kintec studio. Kintec, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we're getting some pushback, not against us specifically, but just in general on the positivity in the market right now. Little Sammy texts in, why the hell are we so positive about things right now? We essentially went all in based on the Lindholm trade, the Hronek trade, the OEL buyout, Miller aging, etc. They pushed their chips in and they lost. How can they improve now? That's from Little Sammy. Another one, unsigned. Guys, well, we can all say what a great season. What is so hard about saying we lost to a team below us in the standings and caved? Not just lost, but completely wilted after being up 3-2 in games with the opportunity to go to the Western Conference Finals.
I thought I did say success.
And again, I just don't think it's mutually exclusive. Of course, you got to be disappointed after going up 3-2 in the series.
Well, and I like the thing I'd push back on is like the notion that they were right there with Edmonton. I think you're ignoring the material edge that Edmonton had and showed once their backs got pressed up against the wall in this series.
That's fair. But either way, like no matter how you slice it, it's totally fair to be disappointed. You went up 3-2. You got those two performances in game 6 and 7. Like, of course you're going to be disappointed as a fan. I just don't think it invalidates everything else the team did this year, right? I don't think it invalidates how far they came. It's part of the story. It's not, I agree, don't hand wave it away. Don't act like it wasn't a huge missed opportunity to advance to the Western Conference Finals. It was, but you just have to see it in the context of everything else. Now, to Little Sammy's text, right? They pushed so many of their chips in, they lost. How can they improve now? I think that's a very fair question. That's a very, very fair question, right? And I know I was just watching during the break our pal Rick Dhaliwal over at Donnie and Dolly, who will be on the show as part of the crossover tomorrow, doing just kind of a quick rundown of some of the big UFA and RFA decisions facing the Canucks. And more than anything, what stands out to me is just how long the list is of guys he's checking off here, kind of big time questions that the Canucks have to answer on these players. And so, as we talked about just a little bit yesterday and earlier in the show, this is going to be a very, very different offseason for the Canucks than we're used to. One, because of the way they've raised expectations, because of the management group in charge and the way they performed coming into this year and the way they were able to strengthen the team. Their cap situation is very different. And the challenge in front of them, as you said, to go from not just going from unrespectable to respectable, right? But to go from respectable to an elite contending team while you have Thatcher Demko making what he's making on his deal, while you have JT Miller still performing like he is, right? Like those big considerations still govern what to expect from the Canucks and what they need to do going into this summer.
And don't ignore the passage of time, right? Like Thatcher Demko's 28, 2 years left on his deal, right? Quinn Hughes is 24 now, 3 years left on his deal, right? Like they got Pettersson and Miller signed long-term, but Besser only has 1 year left on his deal. Mm-hmm. He was this team's leading goal scorer, right? Like, time's ticking. Time's ticking away. Pettersson has 1 year left.
Thatcher Demko has 2 years left on his deal, and he'll be 30 when
right.
it expires.
But also, Pettersson has 1 year left in what we consider to be a statistical prime, which isn't to say that, like, the player immediately is useless, right? Like, sometimes you get better at the business of hockey and of winning hockey games, even as your output diminishes somewhat. But, like, you know, you're kind of here now with what you've got. And you know, between 2021, when the team took Klimovich in the second round and traded their first for OEL and Garland, right, last year when they traded multiple picks for Hronek, and then the deals made to bolster this team, right, which cost them their first and their second round pick, you know, you're missing the boat on a lot of opportunities to try, it's by no means a lock, but to try and get like your answer to Stankoven and Johnston, which, again, that doesn't happen very often, but if you don't have the picks, like if you can't play, you definitely can't hit it. And if you don't, you know, like Dallas has shown us that's the way to navigate. They have they've got to have the most expensive middle six in the history of the NHL. I'm serious.
Yeah, with Sagan and Ben.
Sagan and Ben are like third liners for them at a combined cost of $19.35 million, right? And then also in their middle six, you've got Dadonov at 2.25 and Marchman at 4.5, right? Like, it's wildly...
What's Duchesne making this year also? Like
three?
Three something, yeah.
And at least Pavelski plays top line minutes for them. But Duchesne's at three. I'm pretty confident about that. So, yeah. So, you know, that's an expensive middle six, but you can get away with it when you've got, you know, your 1C and 2C in terms of minutes played in the playoffs, making nothing, making literal peanuts to be really, really good at hockey for you. At some point, you know, I do think to level up, there's going to need to be, and especially to navigate the OEL buyout years, the possibility that eventually Miller has to shift to the wing as he ages, right? Something that the club is aware of. You know, at some point, you are going to need to land some stars, which is, you know, first of all, really turns up the stakes for the player development of like Lekarimäki and Tom Volander, right? Because that's what the club has in the cupboard now.
Mm-hmm.
But also, if you have the opportunity to swing for a big deal and you have limited draft capital, what's the first thing every team is going to want?
Lekarimäki
and Tom Volander.
Yep.
So it's a really tough balancing act that this club's going to have to navigate, and not to mention the fact that all of these players, you know, by virtue of their contributions to a team that shocked a lot of the hockey world with what they accomplished this year, all of them have increased the price of the brick.
Yep.
Just is what it is.
And just to run through some of what Rick Dhaliwal had to say, and obviously we'll get more into it with him on the crossover tomorrow, just kind of, again, real broad brushstrokes here. They're going to try on Joshua and Elias Lindholm. Lindholm, it would remain very, very surprising if there's a deal to be done there, just given the team's cap situation, given what he's going to be able to command on the open market. This is my editorializing, not what Dhaliwal is saying. He's saying they're going to try on Joshua and Lindholm. Nikita Zadorov, he thinks, has priced himself out of the Vancouver market. Tyler Myers, as we've talked about a lot, kind of comes down to he's going to be able to get more than what the Canucks want to give him on the open market, especially considering how good he was in the playoffs for the Canucks. So it just comes down to how much does he value staying in British Columbia?
Well, and I think the answer is probably significantly, but as you'll find out typically in these like hometown discount or like player open to hometown discount scenarios that you have to get in the same ballpark.
Yes.
Like Jacob Markstrom wanted to stay in Vancouver. The Canucks didn't get into the same ballpark, so he went to Alberta. And, you know, my guess is, you know, if you're close, then a player's affinity for the province and for the city makes a huge difference. If you're not in the same world, right? If Myers is staring down 2x5.5 from somewhere, which, by the way, like, given his production this year and size and unique profile, like, don't necessarily count that out. You know, that changes things. Right?
Yeah. Yeah. So that's very much an open question.
Yep.
Very, very much. I would say more likely than a Nikita Zadorov return, given how, like, his profile and his physical profile and all of that.
And his
age. The way he seized the spotlight in the playoffs and his age. But it's not by far far from a foregone conclusion that they'll be able to work it out with Tyler Myers. And then the other one, of course, this is an RFA. Rick Dhaliwal reporting that Filip Hronek not budging so far, at least, from his $8 million ask on a long-term extension with the Vancouver Canucks.
Yeah, and for arbitration-eligible players, right, like, so there's a lot of different deadlines that matter here. The first is qualifying offer. We went through this with Brock Besser, right? Now, Hronek doesn't have a prohibitive qualifying offer, so I don't think it's the same level of pressure point, but mm-hmm. First, you qualify a player to maintain your right of first refusal and keep them as an RFA. That happens, you know, between the draft usually and free agency. Then you sort of get an arbitration hearing set. There's a small window in which a player can usually be offer sheeted, depending on whether it's player elect or team elect arbitration. And then once you have that hearing, you also are like both in Toronto. And both are preparing to meet with an arbitrator. And you know that the experience is not going to be super fun for anybody involved. And usually, if you end up at arbitration with a player, You know, you get a 1 year award in Filip Hronek's case, and that's probably the last year they're playing for you, right? Like, it's not like it used to be where it was really acrimonious, you know, like the Kyle Wellwood hearing, famously in Canucks history, the Brendan Morrison hearing famously in Canucks history. It's not as, it's a little more professionalized these days than it used to be, but it's usually a very bad sign for a relationship if it gets there. You also are no longer able to settle once an arbitration hearing has begun, which you used to be able to do. So sometimes arbitration hearings would begin, and then before it ended, before an award had to be issued, before you got the, like, sometime after you got the this is how far apart the two sides are in their award presentations, and the hearing actually concluded, the teams come to an agreement. Now, if you go to arbitration, it's done.
Yeah.
Teams hate this. Teams hate arbitration, right? Because A, it's man hours. You have to spend working pretty hard in August. No one in hockey wants to work in August. Secondly, there's a lot of uncertainty. Like, you're shopping on July 1 and you are like, well, we have to save 6 to 7.5 or, you know, in Hronek's case, maybe as much as 8 million in case the arbitrator awards against us.
Mm-hmm.
And Hronek has a really strong case. We've gone over this, right? 50 points, right-handed defenseman, led Canucks skaters in even strength ice time. You know, one of the things that you can present to an arbitrator is like a case that your individual contributions significantly impacted the success or failure of the team. That's a pretty straightforward case to make in Hronek's, for Hronek, right? Like, we're talking about a guy who came to a team that had struggled massively, leads them in minutes, scores 50 points, plays top pair minutes, and year one, they're a division winner?
Yep.
I mean, that's a case, a meaningful case that Filip Hronek and, you know, his representatives with Octagon can make. So, it, you know, the Hronek example to me is especially high leverage and also something that, depending on how it plays out, can prevent the Canucks from doing other things in the interim. Potentially result in an award that the club doesn't control, right? Tying up their cap space. And, although they would be able to walk away from him because he's likely to get an award at a high enough level. And also the arbitration status restrains his trade value significantly, because if what I just walked you through sounds like a headache, it's a headache for everybody. Mm-hmm. No one wants to deal with these. So that's sort of the dynamic here. But the idea that they're not budging, to me, is not like even a bad sign or a negative. Like, why would you budge? There's all of these various pressure points that favor the player and that put the team in an uncomfortable situation over the course of the next 2 months. Like, this isn't the time to deal if you're Hronek unless you get exactly what you want. So that would be the context that I'd urge everyone to consider. Like, it's not a great situation, right? Arbitration eligible players are headaches for a reason, but, you know, a lack of progress isn't meaningful at this stage, because why would you make progress when the leverage is only going to go further in your favor over the next 2 months?
But also, from the Canucks' perspective, and this text comes in, H from Van, is Hronek traded at the draft? Like, how much appetite is there really to go all the way to an arbitration hearing, or even to, like, to do the, you know, hey, an arbitration hearing is set, but then we settle in August right before it thing, right? Like, that, as you, to me, the crucial thing there is that it is tying up your ability to really be aggressive at the key parts of the offseason, July 1st and the draft trading window, right? Like, if you don't have certainty on Hronek, that makes it really, really tough to have that type of Jim Rutherford aggression that I think they're going to need if they're going to improve this team this year, right? So you're right that it makes total sense for Hronek not to really start budging now, right, when the pressure points for him are way farther down the line. But the flip side of that logic is, can the Canucks afford to kind of play that game with a player whose production and impact fell off significantly in the second half of the year?
Yeah, it's a good question, especially, you know, one thing we know about this management group is they do want to have their ducks in a row. They want to position themselves to be aggressive. We saw that with the Oliver Ekman-Larsson buyout last year, right, where they did the buyout in contrast with what we usually see, which is teams waiting until the absolute 11th hour to do it, right? Explore all other options, exhaust all other options before you actually exercise the ordinary course buyout. They did it right, immediately, like the hour the window opened, right? It was a spectacular, and then you put that cap space to good use. that's kind of something that's in their MO. They want the certainty because they'll probably have some targets that they want to hit in free agency. So, you know, the Hronik one is fascinating. I'd add this, like, you know, Hronik's agent Alan Walsh was at a lot of Canucks playoff games, right? Like he's been in the city a lot during this playoff run. I'd imagine, given his proximity to the team, that they would have had at least some talks, some discussions in the interim. If there's no progress yet, you know, that is a data point, not a cause for concern, but just a data point to be mindful of as we track this story all off.
And I think a lot of it comes down to, you know, we started this conversation noting Rick Dhaliwal was reporting that there's been no budging from Philip Hronek on the $8 million price tag. And so much of this from the Canucks perspective comes down to, is that just a temporary thing because we're so far from arbitration, or is there any meaningful chance that they budge? How much would they be willing to budge? Because if the answer to those questions is you think they're probably not going to, and even if they did, it wouldn't be a lot, then this is the time for that Jim Rutherford willingness to, you know, one, get his ducks in the row, but also like not be married to players, not be married to even star acquisitions that he made, right? And we've already seen that with the Canucks trading Andre Kuzmenko in the Elias Lindholm deal, potentially exploring flipping Elias Lindholm at one point before the deadline as well. But I just don't see how you can kind of wait and hope that the number comes down to where you're to where it would make sense for you, right? Like, I think you have to be more proactive than that. And I think this is going to be a theme of the whole offseason and the whole summer for Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin, right? Like, yes, you staked a lot on the Philip Hronek trade and it worked really, really well. But don't follow that up with a mistake on the next deal. Be willing to walk away or be willing to at least move the player in a bold deal at the draft, something like that ahead of the draft, rather than follow it up with that next mistake. I think Jim Rutherford throughout his career has shown that he has the willingness to do it, but it's absolutely essential to how the team operates this summer. Not just in the Hronek case, but I think especially in the Hronek case. Do not fall in love with the player just because he was a signature acquisition.
Well, yeah. I mean, I think they have fallen in love with the player, and I think it's because of how well he complimented Quinn Hughes, but there's definitely, you know, the flag planting bias, right? Like Philip Hronek more than any other Canucks acquisition was the one that this market reacted negatively to until
he started playing.
Yeah. And then reacted massively positively to, and then maybe got a little carried away with how much praise there was for the agreement, right? Or for the deal and for the early returns. And it's tends to be tough to walk away from the deal that, you know, is like the perfect case that you guys have the answer. I mean, there's no better case for...
But that sense has changed a lot over the last 3 months.
You think so?
Absolutely. In terms of fan temperature, 100% it has. Yeah, like, but if that's playing into the mindset at all, it has a lot.
But it's not about fan temperature. It's also about the internal temperature.
Sure. But what I'm saying is, like, if you're saying that the reaction to the market is part of what creates that flag planting impulse, I think the reaction from the market changing then is part of the story as well.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely can be, but I don't think it necessarily is. The, you know, because it's not ultimately about fan temperature. It's about
what they think. Of course. I'm just saying, like, if and I'm not saying they would ever think this consciously, but you're talking about just kind of like the background decision-making biases that we're all prone to, right? That we're all susceptible to.
And the idea internally, like, we've got the guys with the answers. Proof's in the pudding. We saw it this season. Look at the Hronek trade. Look at what everyone said about it. Look at how it turned out. Right? That's the bias thought process I'm talking about.
I get that. I just think, again, like, based on the reaction we're getting in right now, like, we're not getting in anyone, zero texts that are like, oh, they need him with Quinn Hughes. They need him to support Quinn Hughes.
I get it. But also, I think we need to, and we'll be talking about this a lot more, we're now in an era of cap growth for the first time in a long, long time. So we've become so used to hearing a number that's like slightly higher. Honestly, we're so used to hearing a number that's totally reasonable and reacting like, whoa,
yep,
you can't do that for this long. And in a world where the
$3 million for a third line player? It's like, what are they thinking, right? And you're like,
$3 million in term?
Yeah.
And we're about to enter this moment where, like, honestly, over the course of the next 6 weeks, unless teams are super disciplined collectively, collude, you're going to see some contracts that basically have no relationship to what's come before. Like, you are going to have to reset your expectations on what guys make, and it's going to be incredible how quickly some of these deals date, right? If you're the Canucks, the way to think about it, or the way that I think about it, is like, the Leafs lost Zach Hyman in free agency. 50 goal scorers Zach Hyman scored in Game 7 to help the Edmonton Oilers advance to the conference final. He signed for $5.5 million with term in Edmonton. The Leafs replaced him for $900K with Michael Bunting, who was a huge success in Toronto. Like, a massive, no doubt about it, success. Over the 2 years that Michael Bunting spent in Toronto as Hyman's replacement, he scored 46 goals and had 115 points for $900K a year.
Mm-hmm.
Would you rather be the team that signs Michael Bunting for $900K or the team that signs Zach Hyman for $5.5? The answer is usually pretty easy, except Zach Hyman's a 50-goal scorer.
Yeah.
You know who Michael Bunting is not? Zach Hyman, right? So Quinn Hughes had the same results as Ethan Bear, or with Ethan Bear as he did with Philip Peronic. So that follows. You can lose Philip Peronic and replace him with the Michael Bunting right-handed defense equivalent. But you know what you then don't have? Philip Peronic, right? I do think that we're in this moment where, like, luxury spends.
There's still a breaking point, though. There's still a tipping point.
There is. Right? But and luxury spends are doable now.
Yeah. I think your point is that the tipping point where it becomes unwise is probably higher than most fans are thinking right now, but it still exists, right?
And when it pertains to more common pieces, not right-handed defensemen who play at the top of your lineup, right? And, so just keep that in mind. Like, I'm not opposed. I don't think Philip Peronic at 8 is a deal that necessarily ages badly, provided that he fits like this with Quinn Hughes. I don't. I honestly don't even think it's, like, remotely unreasonable. And I just think we're not used to being, like, wait till you see what Brett Pesce signs for. Wait till you see what Brady Shea signs for.
Yeah, I'm still not on board with the $8 million. I take your point about the luxury spends thing. I just think, again, $8 million to me clears that breaking point where you got to go for the budget option and deal with the talent differential.
But in 2 years, the equivalent of 8 is going to be like what we now think of as 6.5, which no one would bat an eyelash.
Yeah. Okay. We'll take a break here. Dan Murphy is going to join us on the other side. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. And we will wrap up the show with Sportsnet's Dan Murphy next here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. It is Jamie Dodd and Thomas Strantz here live from the Kintec Studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber, with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver, online at DunbarLumber.com. Final segment of the show here. Very pleased to be joined from Sportsnet. Normally, he's only ever been on the show when I have been off the show and Drance has been solo. So very thrilled to get a chance to chat with Dan Murphy. What's going on, Murph?
Well, if I would have known you were on the show today, I would have refused.
That's what I thought. Somebody must have misinformed you. You're like, well, I have to talk to Jamie? What?
I'm doing good. How are you guys doing today?
We're doing well. We're having fun. Obviously, you know, for the fans, disappointing end to the season last night, but still lots to dig into. I mean, we'll start just quickly on Game 7 here. What did you kind of think of the Canucks' performance and the way the season came to an end last night?
Well, I mean, I'll say this. I mean, I think fans have the right to be upset that it's over and maybe disappointed with how games 6 and 7 went because clearly we didn't see the Canucks at their best. what I didn't have time for is the takes that there was no effort. I mean, of course there was effort. It's game seven. But what there was probably also was nerves and fatigue. And what that led to is bad execution. And when you have bad execution, it leads to defending and then more fatigue and probably more nerves and more defending. And by the time they got their legs, it was just a little bit too late. So, you know, I think it's too bad that we really didn't see the Canucks have a performance in game six or seven like they did in game five, because it was there. And I think maybe if that game was 5 minutes longer last night, we do see an overtime. But I don't think you can say that, you know, the better team didn't win, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, the Oilers were the better team on a whole in that series. The Canucks were gamers. They had some comebacks. They were opportunistic. They were without their number one goalie, their number one goal scorer in game seven. And so, you know, it is a disappointing outcome to be that close to a conference final. But I don't think the fans or the team should feel, you know, hard done by with how it ended.
Murph, I was talking earlier about how at the end of the day, no matter what, you can't say this team didn't have balls. Like, they had real balls. They showed it even last night. Despite what I thought was a pretty low-energy performance, and I don't know if it's just that they ran out of runway or if the Besser news or nerves, as you said, sort of impacted them for the first 50 minutes, but we still saw that fight. What does the fight and magic that this team was able to sort of conjure, especially late in games that they maybe had no business winning? I mean, when you think about Game 1 of the Oilers series or Game 4 of the Nashville series, do you sort of extrapolate that to have learned anything about this group in general?
Well, I think it changed the narrative around this team, because we were just so used to over the last decade, minus some moments in the bubble and stuff, that if things went wrong, they weren't going to go right in that game, right? It was over. And even covering the team, it takes a while to get used to it, because you're just so used to the worst case scenario. If they get scored on early or it's 2-0, they've got no chance, right? I mean, we were accustomed to that over the last decade. And even this season, like, I have to admit that at points, I was like any other doubter. They get off to a good start, well, of course they're going to fall back to earth. And then they play 500, and then they come out of it. And then, you know, they lose three in a row, oh, this is it. And then, you know, the Oilers are charging, well, they're going to lose the division. You kind of had to reset every time and say, you know, it's not the same old Canucks. So I think they changed the narrative. We learned that anyway, right? There was some fight in this team.
Yep.
You know, they didn't behave like Canucks teams in the past that we were used to, that kind of was beaten into our consciousness. So I'll say that by the end of the season, even though last night was going poorly, very poorly for 40 minutes, 45 minutes, I thought, like, if they do get a goal, and I you know, I thought they're going to press, they're going to have a moment, maybe they don't get one, but if they do get a goal, I think they can make it interesting. And I think that if that was, you know, game 40 of the regular season, I wouldn't have felt that way, because I still hadn't been conditioned to believe that they had that in them.
We were talking earlier in the show about kind of what were the biggest storylines from this Canucks season. You know, what will we kind of remember most about this season, looking back on it next year, a few years down the road? Do you have a thought off the top of your head kind of what the biggest storyline for you from this Canucks season was?
Well, I think there's a few. And I'll say this. You know, I can't imagine players, you know, turning things around and changing the narrative about themselves more than JT Miller and Tyler Myers by the end of the season.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are guys, and you know, I was one of those people that said I think they should keep Horvat, and they didn't. And I thought that might be a mistake, and clearly, you know, it wasn't. Who knows how the contract ages? But I mean, this guy went from kind of being a bit of a pariah to, I would say, maybe the fan favorite on the team at this point, right?
No question.
You know, embodied kind of the character of this team, the heart. And so there's that. And then Tyler Myers as well, right? You know, the whipping boy. We only ever wanted to talk to him at the end of games because something went wrong. But the system and having some defensive partners and some trust, you know, I think that by the end of the season, like after that game in, what was it, Tampa?
Yeah.
Was it Philly, then Tampa? We had a cut.
Yeah, it was the Tampa one where he bowled over Patterson on the game winner.
Yeah, I don't think we really had a lot of discourse about that player. And could you imagine that after the last five seasons? So I'll say that for one thing. And then the other thing, like 12, 14 months ago, you had Besser and Garland and their camps. Now, I'm not going to say they made trade requests, but I think everybody was open to a fresh start for players, both team, agents, and players. It didn't happen. And then you had those two players have the season they had. You know, Besser was excellent in the regular season. He was their leading goal scorer in the postseason. Garland, I mean, he's a fighter. So I think I'll take away that there was players that I don't think were, you know, really, I'm not going to say loved, because I think Besser was loved, but, you know, the fan base was a little bit indifferent. And in the Myers case, you know, not even indifferent, you know, didn't like him as a player. But by the end of the season, I think all four of those guys have become players that the fan base not only likes or loves, but now trusts and doesn't really see a future without them, which is bizarre to say.
So the future is obviously always on people's minds whenever something ends, right? And this was a tremendous Canucks season, a dream campaign pretty much from nose to tail. And yet, as we sort of consider what's next, I'll start with the big picture question and then ask something more specific. But, you know, what's your priority? What do you think? Big picture stuff. So not a specific player or anything, but like what this team needs more of so that the next time they bump into McDavid and Draisaitl in the playoffs, it goes differently.
Well, I do think they need some more top six high-end talent. I would have liked to see what this team could have done with a Gensel in the top six in these playoffs. You know, I just don't think, and, you know, nothing against these guys, but throughout the season, you were rotating any number of Hoglander, PDG, Lafferty, Mikheyev through your top two lines and playing with your top two centers before Lindholm got there. So I really think one of the priorities has to be to find one or two top six wingers. And that's easier said than done, but I think you do need that. I think if they would have had that come playoff time, they wouldn't have had as much troubles, I don't think, with Nashville of generating or scoring. And I think that could have made a big difference in the Edmonton series as well. So I think big picture, that's what I'd look at. Of course, we have to find out what's going to happen with Myers, what's going to happen with Zadorov. What's going to happen with the defense, because you're going to have to keep addressing the right side no matter what, how much Hronek's going to cost. So I think once you do get into the specifics of certain players, there's a lot of questions, but I think that's, for me, the biggest thing they need to address. And I may be off base, but that's just my first thought.
And then to ask a similar question, because I think that's a great answer, but to ask a similar question but somewhat more specific, among the many expiring players that the Canucks are going to be negotiating with, dealing with, making tough decisions on this offseason, what stands out to you as like the biggest pressure point? Not something that, you know, you think is going to be acrimonious or anything, but just the one to watch as we enter offseason mode.
I think Dakota Joshua, well, Hronek is maybe the easy answer. And I don't know how much you've talked about him, but you know, clearly he's going to reveal what was going on with him. You know, there's something with his elbow. I mean, but last night was the first one time we've seen a guy taken 2 months.
Yep.
Correct? Right?
It's been a long time.
He was playing hurt. And look what it is. He scored a goal. But he hadn't done that for about 2 months' time. So there's something going on there. So I think the easy answer is Hronek and how much he's going to cost. And maybe that's a conversation with Quinn Hughes, how much Quinn likes him as a partner. Because I know the numbers dipped greatly in the second half, and some people were a little miffed at some of his play in the playoffs, but he clearly knows how to get the puck to Quinn, how to play with Quinn, and how to read off Quinn. And that's, you know, that's easier said than done. But I think Dakota Joshua, and, you know, there's not many players that profile like him, you know, in the league, you know, mind you, on the team, right? He's one of one on this team.
Yeah.
And here's where I think the trouble is. If I'm Dakota Joshua at this point, I'm sorry, whatever the situation, if he likes it here, if the team has a chance to win, he's got to cash in this year.
Yep.
So if that means going to Columbus because they give him 5x4 or whatever, He's 27. This is his chance to make his money. I am not going to, you know, quibble with anything that he does. I think he's got to take his max term and his max dollar, and I think that's going to be disappointing news for the Canucks. But, you know, you have to let him do his thing because he has one chance here to really cash in, and that's right now. So I think that's the one, you know, player that I think the Canucks would love to keep because of, you know, how he plays and how big he is and his skill set and his penalty-killing abilities. I just think that might be the toughest one to keep.
So, Murph, obviously we're going to talk a lot about the RFAs this year and the UFAs, and there's such a long list of guys who are key contributors. But, you know, another player that I can guarantee you we'll be talking a lot about, and we already have, who is under contract for a long time, is Elias Pettersson. And, you know, the disappointing playoffs, he was so in the spotlight. Obviously, it was a disappointing season from a production standpoint post-All-Star break for Pettersson. Looking at his entire season kind of in totality, like, how are you viewing Elias Pettersson now? What do you think is kind of a fair takeaway to have from everything we saw from Pettersson this season?
You know, I still am bullish on the player, and only because we've seen this in his career so far. There have been peaks and valleys. The peaks are high. The valleys seem to be a little bit low. You know, maybe there are more plateaus. I'm not sure. He's still young. He's still a point-of-game player in his career. He's going to get stronger. I don't think you have to worry about anything off the ice. I don't think you have to worry about anything in terms of his training. He's a hockey nerd. I think he's a perfectionist. I think he wants to be the best. So I think those are all really, really good qualities. I think that for Elias, it's usually when things aren't going well, it's between the ears. I think he gets in his own head a little bit. It's confidence issues. And that might be, you know, because he is such a perfectionist that when things aren't going well, he's probably a whole lot harder on himself than he needs to be. So I think that if you can iron out some of those things, I think he's going to be a very productive player, you know, down the road. And we forget too, right? People say, oh, he's not a playoff player. Well, I mean, the Twins early on, and they were, you know, same, similar age. They didn't seem like playoff players either, right? The toughness, et cetera. And the other thing is you need players. You hope he grows into one, but you definitely need players like Elias Pettersson to get you to the playoffs.
Mm-hmm.
You need it, right? You need guys that are going to help you win tons of games in the regular season, be productive on the power play, you know, game breakers. So, you know, I'm still bullish on the player. I understand why there's some fans now that are, you know, a little bit like, oh, what did we do? Because maybe he doesn't feel like a playoff player yet, but I wouldn't give up on this guy just yet. That's just me, because I think mainly when he struggles, it's between the ears. And that's what causes his problems on the ice.
When you consider how big a surprise this season was, and you consider sort of how difficult it is with Zadorov and Lafferty, and I mean, you know, the names all expiring. Mm-hmm. How hard do you view this offseason from the perspective of, can this team run in place? Can they improve?
Yeah, I mean, here's the thing. I mean, Zadorov's going to be tough to resign.
Yep.
And, you know, that's too bad because, you know, he is a fan favorite now, too. Mm-hmm. He's just a delight for us in the media. He's a blast to watch on TV, his interviews and his on the ice. The danger with players like this is you pay a guy for, you know, a 5-week sample size instead of what he does throughout the 6 months of the regular season, right? And we've seen guys get big contracts because of what they've done in the playoffs. And it's very difficult to sustain that type of play throughout a full regular season. And I where does he fit in this Canucks team? Is he in the top four on the left side?
No.
I don't know, right? So, can you pay a $5 million a year? I think that's when you get back into the danger zone. So I think he'll be very difficult to replace. You know, I think that I would be very careful for the fans saying trade Hronek and re-sign Zadorov and then get another right shot guy. We've seen how difficult that is to find those young right shot defensemen that can play alongside Quinn Hughes. So I think it's going to be a difficult offseason. The one thing I will say is this. I think that this management group, fans can have faith in them.
Yep.
Targeting the right players in free agency, in trades. Nothing that they've done so far would make me believe that they're gonna you know, miss more than they hit. In fact, they hit a lot more than they miss. And I don't know what messaging changed to the scouts. I don't know what they told them to look for differently, but clearly there has been a change in how they go about their scouting, and it's worked. So if you do lose some of these guys, you're like, oh man, I wish we didn't have to lose, you know, whoever.
Mm-hmm.
I think that this group has done a good job in proving that they know who to target. They might not always get that player, but they've done a pretty good job in filling in those gaps, especially with guys near the bottom end of the lineup and the bottom end of the D pairs. So I think that at least, as difficult as this might be, seeing some of your favorite depth guys or role players walk out the door, you know, I think fans should have faith in Rutherford and Alvin to be able to find guys to replace them.
Murph, we really appreciate the time. Thank you for doing this. Thank you for toughing it out through a conversation with me. I appreciate that. The resilience is noted, and have a great summer, man.
You got it, boys. Another good season. I wouldn't have minded have been going to Dallas tomorrow.
No,
but,
kidding.
As the great Todd Bertuzzi once said, it is what it is.
No Pecan Lodge, man. That's a tough blow for me, but good for my waistline, so it's all good.
and the gingerbread trail or whatever.
Yeah,
that,
let's
that,
go.
That dive bar. That was good, too.
Thank you, Murph.
All right, boys.
See you, buddy.
That is Sportsnet's Dan Murphy weighing in here on some of the things that happened for the Canucks this year and some of the challenges going forward. And, yeah, as Murph said, more high-end talent in the top six. I think that's going to be a pretty unanimous response. The more people we run that question by, right? Our conversation certainly starting there. We're hearing that in the inbox. I expect when we hear from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin in their availability, which I think is going to be on Thursday. I think they'll do all players and management. That's not confirmed, is it? But that's kind of my understanding.
Do you Great. Know? Love that.
So don't hold me to that, but it might
usually
it might be a package deal on Thursday.
Usually the Canucks have done players one day and then
all right,
management.
So it might be it might be Thursday, Friday.
But man, one day sounds pretty good. Something to consider.
I don't want to get your hopes up. But anyway.
Earth to C-Mac, one day, baby. One day.
I don't now I feel like I'm on very shaky ground here. I don't want to get my just because
oh, I'm just
mind.
Kidding.
No, I know. But I don't want to get your hopes up.
No, don't worry about it.
But anyway,
my hopes are never up.
That's a good rule for life. Whenever they speak, like I imagine we hear something very similar from Jim Rutherford and Patrick Alvin. Jim Rutherford was up front going into the trade deadline. We need more top six help. So it's not new. It's not a new issue that they're unaware of. And I think that is going to be kind of the dominant how do they get better discussion. Because, yes, you have to ace, again, replacing or retaining the Bluger, Lafferty, Ian Cole class, but then you also need to find a way to supplement in a much higher spending bracket up the top of your lineup.
Well, and I also think the key here, right, is what you need is at the top, which is, on the one hand, the hardest and most expensive pieces to land.
Mm-hmm.
But on the other hand, if you can find those pieces, then you get all this like cascading impact from pushing certain guys down the lineup. Like when this team had Pugh Suter and Nils Höglander and Sam Lafferty on the fourth line and Garland on the third, like my God, right? The one moment where I was like, are they going to be able to sustain this shooting clip was when they were cooking with like a bunch of guys who I'm like, that guy's a bona fide top six forward. That guy's a bona fide middle six forward, and he's playing fourth line center, right? Because all of a sudden, you've got Pugh Suter and Nils Höglander doing outrageous stuff against
the other team's fourth line.
X quad A guy that some teams, and that is something we just don't see very much, right? Like, Garland is so good, and yet we don't see guys that good often play as much against, you know, bottom six competition. Partly because he's short, but also it's a huge edge that the Canucks had for much of the season. And then you get to the playoffs and, you know, you've dealt Beauvillier, you've dealt Kuzmenko, you've got the Besser injury, right? And all of a sudden it's like you're the team with the quad A guys up and down your lineup, right? Finding some guys, whether they're drivers or whether they're like connective tissue guys, but just guys who can give you a little bit more bottom line than Mikheyev and, you know, I think next season could look a lot different for Mikheyev if he's on the third line, right? Or on the fourth line. I think the season can look an awful lot different than the playoffs did for Nils Höglander if he's back to being bottom six game breaker guy. So, you know, that's sort of the tough thing that this team needs to evaluate is what they need is at the top, you know? And that ain't easy.
No, as you said, the most expensive, most difficult thing to acquire, right? If we're talking about high-end offensive talent, but that is very much the task in front of them to really make this season count, use it as a stepping stone rather than an endpoint.
I know we got to run, but let's just thank everybody now that the season's done. Like, bookend the Canucks season by thanking all of you who listened to
Absolutely.
Canucks Talk, who listened to the whiteboard throughout this season. We have a lot of fun doing the show, even if we, like, squabble sometimes on air. And you know, we wouldn't have nearly as much fun without you guys making us laugh in the inbox and without all the awesome, like, interplay with our audience. So thank you guys for sticking with us all season. And guess what? We're going to keep doing this.
We're not going anywhere.
Till July. So
yeah, I concur with that. I second that. And then, okay, we're back to noon to two tomorrow.
Yep.
And then we are on the air as Canucks Talk until July 5th. So through free agency, through the draft.
And we may reconfigure the whiteboard.
We'll got to figure something out.
Well, for
it does
the off-season.
Not work now. So we'll go to the whiteboard and try to come up with a new edition of the whiteboard for the offseason. We'll
but we will come
out.
Up with something.
We will come up with something. All right. Thanks for listening. We're back tomorrow here for more Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.